Welcome, everyone. So my name is Adam Pearce, and it's my pleasure to help facilitate this discussion about consumer engagement in lab-based discovery research. And I would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we are hosting today's discussion, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and celebrate their enduring connections to country, knowledge, and stories. I would also like to pay respect to elders past and present and extend that respect to all First Nations peoples. So a quick background about me. So in a previous life, I was actually a lab-based researcher who worked at the bench, but I now work as a program manager within the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, which is on the Children's campus here in Melbourne. And here I help manage a large research program aimed at bringing together researchers, clinicians, and consumers to help improve the lives of kids with heart disease. And our research program includes a patient advocacy group that is designed to help create a two-way flow or relationship between consumers and researchers. But based on my experiences in this role and previous roles, I am aware of the disconnect that exists between consumers and lab-based researchers who are undertaking discovery research. So today, I will be joined by a fantastic panel who are very uniquely placed to share their lived experience from either the lab side or the consumer side, as well as some who have experience of both. So we acknowledge that the terms consumer, person with lived experience, and participant are used interchangeably in this space. And while no single word encompasses everything we're talking about today, for the purposes of this discussion, we'll be using the word consumer. So why are we here today and what's the aim? So the aim is to discuss and raise awareness of the disconnect that exists between lab-based discovery research and consumers. And within this group discussion, we will unpack some of the assumptions and the attitudes of both consumers and researchers on this topic. We will identify barriers to engagement from both sides. And finally, we will suggest some potential steps that might help to improve engagement, communication, and ultimately align expectations. So I'll now ask each of our panelists to briefly introduce themselves, and we'll start with Oliver and then go to Vicky, David, and finally Holly.
I'm Oliver Hunter. I am 27 and I have cerebral palsy, and I've been involved in the disability space in a range of different roles as a consumer investigator and research, a consultant, touching on access and different employment opportunities for people with disability. And I also perform a bit of stand-up comedy, which is a bit of fun. So that's me.
My name is Vicky, and I'm a parent of a 30-year-old woman with cerebral palsy. My long-standing passion is to empower other parents to have a voice and to actively participate in all aspects of their child's care so that they can achieve better outcomes. Over 25 years ago, I co-founded a parent support group, which has now grown into a leading statewide disability organisation. And I've held senior roles across multiple disability organisations. These roles have provided me with the opportunity to represent families and develop trusted relationships with researchers to support change in the sector. And I've been actively involved in multiple research projects as a parent research partner, and I wish to continue to use my personal and professional experiences to increase opportunities that align research goals with parent contribution. I believe that parents bring a valuable and unique perspective that can only enhance research and making it relevant and impactful.
Hi, everyone. My name is David, and recently I completed a four-year research degree with honours at Monash University with majors in genetics and biochemistry. As someone affected by Duchenne muscular dystrophy, or DMD for short, which is a genetic disease, I'm particularly interested in medical research and how we can improve the quality of life of those affected by disease. And currently I'm lining up a PhD in genetics next year, studying how stem cells could be used to treat my own disease. So having experienced both the lab and consumer side, I'm excited to discuss how we can connect the two sides together.
Hi, my name is Holly Vokes, and I'm a researcher at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute. I have a bachelor's and a PhD in biomedical science. And my role here is at the bench in a science lab. My work is in the field of stem cell medicine, and stem cells have a huge amount of potential to treat various medical conditions. I'm trying to educate myself around consumer engagement. I think there's value in learning and better understanding the condition that I'm researching from multiple different angles, and that includes people with lived experience. My firsthand experience of the common or traditional opinion in science is that patients can't add any value to research. And including patients in scientific research is perceived by many scientists as new age or useless. And I hope to challenge that way of thinking and open up this line of conversation.
To start the discussion, we'd like each panelist to answer, what does lab-based discovery research mean to you? And Vicky, we'd love to hear from you first on this one.
Sure. So I often think of, you know, how can a lab-based researcher help my child? I know that there are researchers somewhere looking at finding cures or treatments, but it really just seems so far away with what I deal with on a day-to-day basis. And I don't really know what's being researched for my child's disability. So I would like to know what is being researched and what's being done, including the unsuccessful outcomes. I'd like to see what the possibilities are, and I'd like to have some hope and a better understanding of what direction we're heading in. So the reason that so many families look for alternative treatments is because we don't really know what's happening in the research world. And it just feels that anything that researchers discover will take so long, decades, even lifetimes to reach me. So, you know, or to impact me. So for me, you know, they're somewhere in the background. They're not really front of mind for me.
Yeah, I really relate in some way to what Vicky's saying. For me, it's about my relationship with lab-based research and science. I can't really formulate in my head what any of it means, because I don't really have a good relationship with science, and this originates in my year 9 science teacher. I didn't like her as a teacher, so I just switched off from 15. It's never been something I've connected with, as opposed to some of the other research work I've done in the sort of more qualitative and discussion based and philosophical based stuff, I guess, if that's the right way to say that. I guess for me, all lab-based research is the white coats and the microscopes, and I haven't really ever opened my mind to that side of the equation, or that the bench, as it's come up a couple of times.
As someone also with a condition, I definitely understand where Oliver's coming from, but obviously I'm in the unique position where I'm actually involved in the research myself. So I think for me, I've started to learn about how, or at least for me, lab-based discovery is about determining why and how diseases occur, and then from that eventually trying to find a treatment. So I think it's really important for science to be able to communicate this idea, the notion that a lot of what we know about disease actually comes from lab researchers in the first place. You know, this is particularly because people like Oliver and Vicky as consumers are not often in my position where they actually are a researcher themselves. I think communication is really key in this area.
And for me as a scientist, I do spend a lot of time in a white coat and looking down a microscope. But I view discovery research as the fundamental understanding of all medicine. And a prime example of that is the recent mRNA vaccines for COVID-19. That wouldn't exist today if 20 years plus of research hadn't been done on the fundamental research side. And to me, lab-based discovery research is the medical treatment of tomorrow.
So now that we've got an idea about people's attitudes towards lab-based discovery research, we'd really like to know what you guys think consumer engagement means. And so Holly, as a lab-based researcher, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on this to start with.
It's an important question, Adam. And consumer engagement to me means connecting with people that are affected by the disease that I'm researching and understanding directly from that person the realities and the lived experience of that condition. And personally, I've had limited experience with consumer engagement in my research. My experience so far has been to reach out to organizations, including Rheumatic Heart Disease Australia and Heart Kids, which are relevant to my research area, and connect with these well-recognized non-for-profit organizations that are trusted by their respective communities. My hope is to build mutual relationships with these organizations, to learn from their consumer groups, contribute to their information that's going out to patients, and share my research with the organization, patients, and their families. For me as a lab-based scientist, there is no roadmap on how to do this. There's no formal training, and there's very minimal resources out there for how to engage with consumers. So I'm kind of having to learn along the way. David, what's your take on this consumer engagement? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so I think what Holly says about scientists not being able to engage or not having much experience with consumers is definitely something I've seen, because I know from the lab side that researchers are not used to meeting someone like me. When they meet someone like me, they find it very interesting and intriguing. And, you know, there's comments like, you know, this is really cool to meet someone who's actually, to put a face to the disease that I'm researching. They might not say it explicitly like that, but I definitely can tell. And so I think actually meeting a consumer and putting the human face to a disease is actually something really motivating for researchers, not only informing them how to interact with consumers, but for their own personal benefit, it actually can be something that really motivates them. And then on the other side, many affected by disease have little knowledge of what goes on in the lab. From seeing both sides, I can see a real disconnect. So to me, I really think consumer engagement should be about removing this disconnect between both sides. And that means better science communication from the lab side is going to be critical in better involving consumers along the research journey.
So I think we've really foreshadowed some of the potential pain points inhibiting engagement, but it would be really good to unpack some more specific barriers. And as someone who's been on the lab side in my previous role, I know that the misalignment of expectations drives fear of providing false hopes amongst scientists. And given your role, Holly, I was hoping to start with you on this question. So would you mind sharing some insights about this?
Yeah, I agree completely with that, Adam. A really big fear is providing false hope to patients. As a scientist, we often don't know where to start when it comes to consumer engagement. There's no training in science communication. It's almost a completely different discipline. And there are some people out there that do it very well. And it's often you learn it by doing it. And there's also another barrier here, which is a misunderstanding around the timelines that it takes for science to reach a patient in a clinic. So a timeline like 5 years for a sick patient is a really, really long time. But 5 years in a lab, in a research project, goes by with a blink of an eye. And for context, the average time that it takes a person to get a PhD in Australia is 4 years. And that's just the basic learning or training period. So to go developing an entire new therapy, typically you're looking at a 10-year timeframe. And these timeframes are often out of our control. As a scientist, there's a lot of extra safety steps that are necessary that are needed to move from the bench in a lab through all the preclinical testing and then in through all the phases of a clinical trial before it actually reaches a patient that receives it. So from my point of view as a scientist, those are some of the big barriers that come to mind. I don't know, David, if you had anything additional to add to that.
Yeah, I think also an important part of what you're saying about timeline is that it can also take a while in the first place to simply understand how a disease occurs. There's a lot of effort that goes into just initially trying to understand mechanisms of disease. And so that can even add more to the timeline. And in addition, there's also can be a lot of trial and error involved in trying to find a treatment and then eventually approving and testing it. And by nature, discovery research is about discovering things that no one knows yet. So unfortunately, there can't be any guarantees about timeline. And as you said, Holly, no steps can really be skipped if you want to find a safe and effective treatment. And so unfortunately, that leaves us in a place where research can take years and can't or doesn't move as quickly as consumers desire. As also, it can take many years of collective knowledge to treat disease. So for example, my disease, DMD, we've known about it for probably more than 30 years. We know how the disease works, but we still have no real breakthrough in this area. So that's just my disease. And given DMD is still relatively common amongst rare diseases, it can be safe to assume that even rarer diseases may struggle in terms of timeline of research. And I think this is partly why it can be really confronting for researchers to talk to those you are researching, particularly if it's a disease of high severity, because you have in the back of the mind that you don't want to feel like you are telling a consumer bad news. And so that personal aspect, I think, can be quite confronting for a researcher and trying to balance not giving false hope. And then I think for the consumers, one of the barriers can be that they may not have an interest in science. And also for them personally, thinking about your disease can be something you want to avoid. And it feels difficult for a consumer to engage with researchers because as someone with a disease myself, I know the feeling of sometimes you think about your disease and you want to stay away from it because you're having a bad day or something. And so that can be, I think, some of a barrier. So Vicky, I wonder what your thoughts on this as a parent of someone with a disability.
Yeah, I can certainly see your points. And, you know, clearly there are many barriers for both parties, but for families engaging in research, you know, all of these apply to lab-based research as well. However, this type of research also means that as parents, as families, we don't have any personal engagement with research, with researchers. Our direct contact really is with the doctors or clinicians or therapists. So, you know, that can be a bit of a barrier because they're not front of mind. And I think that this is more pronounced for lab-based researchers. So we never really speak or see the lab scientists. So because it feels somewhat like they don't even exist in our world, we don't know what they do or how we could possibly contribute. So, you know, questions come to mind for us, like how could they possibly understand or help us? So other more general barriers, I think, include, you know, lack of awareness by families that they can be part of research in partnership roles, not just as participants. It's a fairly new concept. How do they know where to access it? How do they access it? Particularly for those who are isolated and don't have good social circles or connections to their community or other peers. There's also a fear of failure. And I think somebody touched on this earlier. It's about, you know, what happens if I say something stupid? What if I can't offer anything worthwhile? Having the confidence to contribute or lead to discussions or even lead discussions or even to debate or disagree, it can be quite intimidating, I think, for those who haven't really had much to do with research partnerships before. And also raising a child with a disability can be extremely busy. And it can take a lot of our energy. So finding time that fits around work and family commitments can be really challenging. Another last sort of barrier for me that I can see is the lack of compensation, appropriate compensation. It can also deter some parents and families, either due to the feelings of them being less valued or simply on a more practical level that they just cannot give up paid work or other commitments that they have to contribute their time as a partner without adequate compensation.
Yeah, I agree there, Vicky, as well. And I think another point similar to what you've touched on is, like, we've all touched on it so far about that I felt that I wasn't qualified in other research, but then I was validated and I felt like I deserved to be there. But I think the interesting factor with science and lab-based research is science and lab-based, it's quite a skill-based thing. As a scientist, and David and Holly can attest to this, like, you've trained and you've got sciencey skills. That's probably not a very sophisticated way of saying that, sciencey, but you've got skills. Like, as I said, my relationship ended with Year 9 science and I picked it up again with Breaking Bad. So like, I can turn on a Bunsen burner and that's about it. That's where my skill ends with science. So I feel like that can be a deterrent and can be a barrier because I don't know how to be a scientist. But in terms of the other research I've done and the discussion groups I've been a part of, that's been very qualitative and very opinion-based. And my experience is I can inform you and we can have a conversation. Like, I'm happy to give my opinion. You'd ask anyone related to me, stopping my opinion is more the problem. So I feel like when I'm in those circumstances, I'll talk to anyone about anything. But when it comes to the lab-based stuff, the barrier can be that I don't have the actual skills to be in a lab
So having explored some of the barriers to engagement, we'd now like to conclude our discussion with some ways where we might be able to try and align expectations and strengthen consumer engagement in lab-based research moving forward. So David, can we start with you? Can you share some reflections that you might have on this?
Yeah. So I think the important things I've thought about being someone on both sides is I think it's really important that we could in some way get consumers and scientists to meet each other in person. So one example is bringing consumers into the labs to meet with a scientist or someone like that. If anyone knows Gordon Lynch from Melbourne Uni, he had a student with DMD called Savant, who was also studying DMD, but he had a time where he would get some of the boys in with DMD to meet researchers. And I believe this was on DMD Awareness Day. And so I think it's really this face-to-face talking as humans is something that is really good at connecting people from any sort of backgrounds. And I think that this is really something we can do to help strengthen consumer engagement in this discovery research area. And I think also reflecting on the role that consumers can have in driving research. So I've met a guy with DMD from the US and he his parents actually founded a foundation called Cure Duchenne, which is raising money for funds. So funding research and diagnosis for DMD. And so often I think it can be the consumers who are the most passionate because of their personal connection to whatever disease they're facing. And I think it's really important that the lab or scientists don't ignore the role that consumers can play. I think that's really important. I think, Oliver, is there something you've thought about in how we can help improve consumer engagement?
Yeah, thanks, David. I think for me, to sort of touch on what you've mentioned there, it's about just starting the dialogue, isn't it? Starting the dialogue between scientists and consumers and just getting a message out there, that sort of building that relationship from the ground up. And that could be something as simple as, like, David, you yourself and Holly jumping on a webinar, or Adam jumping on a webinar and going public and opening a discussion and sort of showing both consumers and scientists that this is a relationship that could be fruitful and we could really work together. And I think once the relationship is started and potentially projects are worked on, scientists that may not be as open to consumer involvement, as Holly touched on at the start, we can really open those doors and some really cool work and impactful work can be done in the future.
In addition, what David said about having people, consumers and people with lived experience coming into a lab, I'm assuming you've never been into a lab and seen like what Holly does, that visual perspective of like, oh, that's what that piece of equipment is. That's what that tube of DNA is, you know, like
that
real fundamental stuff. But it seems like to the people in the lab, like, well, that's what we do every day. I think it's quite magic. It's crazy what is being done in there. So
showing that it's accessible, not from like a disability point of view, just as people.
Yeah.
Just that, you can be a part of this and see it, you know, touch it. I don't know, some stuff in science lab you don't want to be touching, but you know, be a part of it and have that real tangible experience. Sometimes I feel with science is I don't have anything tangible or anything that I can relate to. So if you just got, as David's done and has seen already, other people with his disease have been in labs and been part of that, and then the scientists are able to put a face to the disease, which I think is huge.
Great points, Oliver. I really agree, and I think your last point about showcasing good examples of it was what we need on our side as scientists. We need a public example of people that are doing it well and the value that it has. Because we've touched on it before, there is a mindset shift that almost has to happen on our side as scientists to want to come to the table and introduce patients to that table and see the benefit and the potentially fruitful relationship that can come from including consumers in your research. It's a lot of extra legwork, I must say as well. So having a program manager, for example, in our group has been really key in helping me as a scientist reach out to charities and non-profit organizations that are helping connect patients to the research. That's been really fundamental change. And I think if there were more people like that in other research institutes, that would make a really big difference. I also think that there has to be buy-in from both sides to make this worthwhile. You don't want a patient and their family going into a room with a scientist and both parties thinks, what's the point of us even being here? So whether that comes down to Oliver's earlier point about dialogue and conversation or education pieces, I think all of it can be really important. Vicky, as a parent, what's your opinion on this?
Yeah, I've got a few other ideas, but I do echo the comments that I've heard so far, especially about bringing people into the lab so that, you know, we can see. And that sort of brings us front of mind, because I think for me, what was missing is, you know, that whole world that we weren't even aware of. And it does need to be something driven by the researchers as well. You know, there needs to be buy-in and there needs to be good communication. I suppose for me, researchers and families together can increase awareness amongst the community as well of what lab research is, you know, and its importance and what they do and how families can be involved and why. So there just needs to be an awareness raising of all of these concerns and issues, promoting it within peer networks, so face-to-face and online. So there's lots of Facebook groups where families are very actively engaged. There's lots of opportunities there that will help bridge those gaps. So researchers could also build relationships with disability and advocacy organisations, as well as service providers, so allied healthcare and clinicians, and also educate and offer opportunities by connecting them to lab researchers, promoting the benefits of being involved in research. For example, there could be a potential career path for a family member or for somebody that has a personal experience of disability or even a parent, increasing their confidence and helping them to feel valued. value. There's lots of benefits for families and consumers. Researchers could also think about maybe including budgets for their consumer involvement, so not just compensation for that participation or that partnership, but as well as maybe some provision for coaching and mentoring in funding applications. You know, once you have a consumer who perhaps is less experienced and maybe not confident, they will need some coaching and mentoring, and that takes a lot of time from the researchers to help work with them in order to make it more successful. If that coaching and mentoring is not there, then that person's more likely to feel less valued or to be able to contribute more confidently. But most importantly, I'd like to inspire lab-based researchers to want to include families and to see the benefits of us being involved. Because when we're involved, we may be able to work with lab researchers to align our expectations and find a way to address that, you know, fear of false hope that's often experienced by lab researchers. We may be able to help them to feel more confident to address this issue, which can often lead to families seeking unsafe treatments overseas because there is an absence of that hope by our Australian researchers.
In listening to you all, I just thought about the biggest barrier is that first step. And I think everyone said that first dialogue, and both sides don't really understand each other. And that first step doesn't have to be perfect. You know, when you've got two worlds that don't really know each other, it is maybe going to be a bit awkward or a bit strange to begin with because you're both trying to understand each other. So I think in trying to do some work and try and get a bit of understanding beforehand, just inviting people into the lab, inviting them into the conversation early, and then just see what happens. I think that's a really big first step, is don't be scared. Let's just try.
I'm open to a tour as well, Holly.
Come on in.
Get me a white coat and a hazmat suit and I'll be there. Hey.
Hazmat? What do you think we're doing?
Hazmat.
See, this is the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're back on Breaking Bad.
Yeah, there we go. That's all I know. So get me in there. We'll mix some dishes and we'll make it all happen.
Yeah. So I really want to thank all our panelists for such a stimulating discussion on such a vital topic. And to those listening, I hope our initial discussion here has conveyed a sense of that disconnect that exists between the lab and consumers, and that you've also felt a bit energized and excited and felt the positivity that we can create by just stepping outside your comfort zone and just sharing and learning together. As I said, we've only just started the conversation today, but we hope that it is stimulating and that it does make you out there think more about the barriers within your own context, whichever side you're on, as well as potential ways to overcome them and connect more in the future. Again, thank you to our fantastic panelists for your insights and reflections on this important topic, and watch this space.